My name is Michael McCusker. I'd like to read a letter to the editor of the Daily Astorian that I just wrote and delivered earlier this morning. They may or may not print it. And I guess I have to give the disclaimer that this is my opinion and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos. I read in the newspaper that March 30th was Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day. Hasn't that cow been milked enough? I was at the dedication of the National Vietnam Memorial in 1982, and the theme even then was Welcome Home. By that time, most of us had been back stateside from the war a decade or more. I don't know why March 30 was selected. The end of the Vietnam War was a month later, 35 years ago on April 30, 1975. And we lost. A few years after the war, a friend who was also in country gave me a belt buckle engraved with a map of Vietnam and a ribbon that said, Second Place, Southeast Asian War Games, 1962 to 1975. Ironically, March 16th, half a month earlier than Welcome Home Day, is usually remembered as My Lai Day, which might be a more pertinent observance of the war. It is commonplace these days for people to say to war veterans, thanks for your service. I usually reply that gratitude for attempted genocide against Vietnamese is misplaced. The acronym for winning hearts and minds is WHAM, like the bursting of a bomb or shell. I know many Vietnam veterans won't agree that the war was a pointless and egregious waste of life, but a significant number of others do. It is a debate that involves our entire generation and won't end, at least among us, until we are all dead. Then the mythmakers will have a clear field in which to weave their fables to entice future generations into calamitous wars. We should pay attention to what veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan are trying to tell us. Not the authorized voices, but the soul-stricken soldiers and Marines who want the unpleasant truths of their wars known. And that's a letter I just wrote to the Daily Astorian. 150 years ago, the first Pony Express rider set off from St. Joseph, Missouri, for a 10-day mail ride to Sacramento, California. Of course, those rides were made in stages. I think they rode 45 miles to the next and then kept on going until these riders reached Sacramento and then back to St. Joe. I think a rider set off from Sacramento that very same day. I'm not sure. But the rider, the first pony, as they used to call it, the pony, earlier on, who set off from St. Joe was Johnson William Richardson. And he left at 5 a.m. that morning, April 3rd, 1860, 150 years ago. Now we just email. Makes those guys' effort a mockery of it almost. It's like flying over the oceans every day in jet planes, and all those explorers whose ships sank over hundreds of years trying to find out what lay at the other end of those oceans. Another mockery of their effort. Well, today is National U.S. Census Day, and I've been asked a number of questions about the census by a lot of people who especially are concerned about privacy and confidentiality. And I picked up a book a few years ago, which was written about the 1980 census. And it was written by a fellow named Dan Hallisey, who was at the time, or had been, looking at the book jacket, a former state senator in his home state of Arizona. And he's written a number of books concerning the relations between the public and government and the interactions between them. And he does a pretty fair account in this census book. And so I'd like to read a little bit of it to help alleviate perhaps some fears and explain a few things. So we'll start it off with the introduction. If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it. And that's a quote from Abraham Lincoln. Census taking is at least 5,800 years old. The Babylonians, Egyptians, Chinese, and even the Peruvians beat us to it by many centuries, but America has learned fast. In the last 30 years, and again he's writing in 1980, Bureau of Census International experts have trained more than 4,000 technicians and statisticians from more than 90 nations. The 98 census was a decennial or 10-year census, just as this 2010 census is. And ours is the 23rd, I believe, in an unbroken string of enumerations decreed by the American Constitution itself. Every one of these censuses has been conducted when and as specified in spite of wars, depressions, and other calamities. The War of 1812 did damage some records, and much of the material from the 1890 census was destroyed in an accidental fire. One thinks it might be accidental anyway. For 190 years, however, and this is 1980, this would make it 220 years. However, census taking has not only graphed American population on the rise, but has mirrored our change from an agricultural to an industrial economy, and more recently, to a service-oriented one. It has also reflected our gradual change from a rural nation to one of urban and suburban dwellers. Ancient census takers used a number of primitive counting methods, pebbles representing fighting men, for example, or grains of corn for citizens. Cowrie shells served as tallies, and so did colored cords. In the biblical censuses, the coins called shekels did double duty in enumerations. Moses had ordered. They made up the tithe at the same time they counted the people. America's early censuses were tallied by clerks with pencils, making the time-honored four vertical marks and a slash for the fifth. Census taking sparked a revolution in mechanical counters and eventually brought on our age of electric and electronic computers. Hermann Hollerith, who invented an electromechanical counter for the 1890 census, founded the company we know as IBM. The census has also been a major factor in the development of statistical sampling techniques, high-speed printing, and such amazing machines as page turners, microfilm cameras, and FOSDIC, the film optical sensing device for input to computers. The word census comes from the Roman censor, an official responsible for the registration of citizens, evaluation of property, collection of revenue, the spending of that revenue, and the guarding of public morals. The U.S. Bureau of the Census does the first task and something of the second, but it is specifically prohibited from aiding in collecting taxes, and instead of guarding public morals, census takers dutifully count households of unmarried couples with no pointing of fingers. Those census takers make the fabled couriers of the U.S. Postal Service seem pampered by comparison, although perhaps not the Pony Express. They have not only braved a menagerie of animal attacks, but have swum icy rivers and ridden everything from snowmobiles to helicopters and aerial trams to complete their appointed rounds. Some have interviewed nudists, washed diapers, delivered babies, eaten meals with the families they interviewed, and saved lives. School teachers have traditionally served as census takers. So have housewives, students, and retired men and women. Long ago, a director of the Bureau suggested that letter carriers be made the permanent census enumerators. This has actually come about, but in a way he did not intend. All 2010 questionnaires have been delivered to households by mail, and most of them will be returned in the same way. America was born of our forefathers' burning desire to be free, to vote for their own leaders, and to follow their own way of life. It is ironic that the census, conceived as the means of equitably apportioning congressional representation, now involves more Americans than does any other political process, including voting itself. In all, about 97.5% of us have been contacted by the Census Bureau for the 2010 census, and about three times as many about three times as many as usually vote. It is unfortunate and unfair as well that the Bureau has been tarred with the same broad brush that blackened the reputation of much of government. Turned off by Watergate, Koreagate, GSA and other scandals, by rising taxes and by the prying of many agencies into the private affairs. Some Americans complain about answering the questions asked in the census. In actual fact, the Census Bureau has a nearly spotless record of preserving the confidentiality of the information gathered from the people, a record not shared by the Internal Revenue Service, the Social Security Administration, and other agencies. In all census history, only one employee, as of 1980, has ever been found guilty of violating the census law. That was in 1902, when the contents of an industrial report were falsified. A convincing demonstration of Bureau stubbornness in preserving the confidentiality it guarantees was its refusal to give the names and addresses of Japanese Americans in California to the War Department at the outbreak of World War II. The only complaint in recent times was that of a Washington socialite who felt her confidential phone number had been leaked by a census worker. Careful investigation proved the Bureau blameless. Perhaps more surprising is the other side of the coin. Despite occasional scare campaigns about prying questions on privies, income, mortgages, and so on, in all of census history, only two Americans have been fined for failing to answer questions as required by law. Again, that's till 1980. The first American census was taken on the first Monday in August, 1790. Other dates were tried after that, but since 1930, the date has been the 1st of April. This April Fool's Day date does not reflect a misguided sense of humor in Congress or the Bureau of the Census. It just seems to catch more Americans at home. When the 2010 census is completed, its initial impact will be on the apportionment of the Congress. This information must be provided to the President by January 1, 2011, so that congressional redistricting can begin. Although Congress created the census and the Bureau that conducts it and provides the funds for the task, about the only favored treatment our senators and representatives get is the option of being counted either at their Washington address or in their home states. For those who choose the latter, housing data is taken for the Washington resident, which is classified as vacant, usual residence elsewhere, and that's a quote. Population, the first thing to come to our minds at mention of the census, remains the most difficult thing to get an accurate handle on. Time and again, experts, including the Bureau of the Census itself, make predictions far off the mark. In 1943, for example, a Bureau publication stated that by 1980, population growth would have stopped altogether at 153 million. But in 1980, the Bureau betted on something closer to 222 million. Now we're up to about 350 million in 2010. In 1790, the first census counted 3,893,635 Americans, including True Love Sparks, Wanton Bump, and Mercy Pepper. For counting 300 people, a federal marshal or one of his assistants was paid $1. When given the official tally of the 1790 census, President George Washington complained bitterly because he was sure there were well over 4 million Americans. He was correct, but such under-enumeration still seems inevitable today. We have yet to count more than 97.5%, and in 2010, there are in all probability close to 5.5 million, quote, missing Americans, unquote. And that's a usual rate. A miss rate of 2.5% is of concern. More critical is the fact that minorities have a much higher rate. Black Americans have suffered most in this regard and began by being counted as only 3/5 of a man in early censuses. There have been no slaves counted since the 1860 census, but now it is estimated that close to 8% of blacks may be missed in the census. Indians, too, are undercounted far more than whites. In early censuses, they were not counted at all. For those who are counted, the census reports much more than mere numbers of people. It sets down where they live and how. It records age and income, sex and employment, or unemployment. Schooling is cataloged too, along with ancestry and the way one gets to work. There were 4 billion facts gathered in 1970. 2010 should turn up many more. However, this latest census probably has less questions than any other that I'm familiar with. It's almost just like name, rank, and serial number. Population and housing are the subjects of the great demographic or people censuses. Economic censuses take in other years, cover manufacturing, industry, business, agriculture, construction, and transportation. Ongoing Census Bureau surveys update their information and also cover other areas such as crime. There are about 12,000 full-time and permanent part-time Census Bureau employees, at least in 1980. Although apparently it was swelled by 280,000 field troops for the giant task of enumerating about 86 million American households. The first census counted heads for less than a penny each, and the 1980 census cost almost $4 a head. One can imagine what it costs now in 2010. And apparently it is right now, at this very moment, the greatest employer the Census Bureau is during this recession depression. The two drab federal buildings in Suitland, Maryland, that house the Bureau of the Census have been unkindly compared with warehouses. There was a time when the census process itself justified a similar appraisal, a huge bin in which to store all the billions of facts turned up by the enumerators. But the Bureau, if not its quarters, has for some time had a new image. The Bureau considers itself the largest marketing research organization in the world. The busiest segment of the field operation is the Data User Services Division, whose chief sees himself as, quote, marketing manager of a plant producing statistics vital to all Americans, unquote. Congress was the first and for some time the only user of census data. Today there are tens of thousands of others. Some 39,000 of these are local governments that depend on population and other data for federal revenue sharing. Business, too, depends heavily on information gathered in the census, as is evident by the business representatives who come to the rescue when zealous administration cost cutters attempt to slash the scope and funding of the census. Although the Bureau zealously guards the confidentiality of an individual census record from prying eyes, it makes one important exception. An individual or his or her legal representative can request from the Personal Census Service branch proof of birth or other needed information for passports, pensions, job applications, or other reasons. Some 10 million Americans have asked and received such help at minimal cost, probably more now. There is one other letting down of the confidentiality bars. Census records through the year 1900 are open to the public for use of researchers, historians, and genealogists. Each census will be opened 72 years later. And I'd like to now go to the section on confidentiality. We have noted that historically many people have objected to being counted and questioned in censuses. Religious concern was one common reason, but there were many others. Leading figures in England and Europe branded the enumeration of people and property, quote, a scandalous invasion of privacy, unquote. Yet, surprisingly, when America instituted its countrywide census in 1790, not only did federal marshals count heads and collect other facts from each household, they were also required by law to post copies of the findings thus gathered at, quote, two of the most public places in their respective districts, there to remain for the inspection of all concerned, unquote. Hardly a comforting precedent for confidentiality. It may seem remarkable that there was no revolt against this first sensual invasion of American privacy. However, the facts collected and so publicly displayed were most likely known by just about everyone before being spotlighted in the town square. Unlike the colonial censuses, those of 1790 and 1800 recorded only names of heads of family, number of free persons by age and sex, and the number of slaves in each family. By 1810, however, census questions began to grow in number and inquisitiveness. The motive was generally good, to learn how healthy the new nation was, how many citizens were literate, how many had served in the military, the original reason for the biblical census and other early ones, plus token information on manufacturing, trade, crop production, and so on. For all its good intentions, however, this development in census-taking brought vocal objections from many. This included businessmen who saw the questions as attempts to tax them more and at the same time broadcast their trade secrets. In response to this outcry, each federal marshal and assistant in 1840 was told for the first time, quote, to consider all communications made to him in the performance of his duty relative to the business of the people as strictly confidential, unquote. As the lists of questions grew longer and more prying, marshals were given further warnings about the confidentiality of the information they were gathering. Specifically, they were expected to consider the facts entrusted to them as if obtained exclusively for the use of the government and not to be used in any way to the gratification of curiosity, the exposure of any person's business or pursuits, or for their private emolument who, while employed in this service, acts as agents of the government in the most confidential capacity. And that's a quote. In other words, no stealing of secrets or taking bribes for so doing. In 1850, each person was required to have his name, and just his alone, recorded, together with specified details in a number of areas. Slaves were to be personally identified, and certain data was also recorded about each. Farmers, manufacturers, miners, and tradesmen were required to describe more details of their operations. It was thus a blessing that with the 1850 census, the posting of the actual forms in public places was discontinued, for the questions asked were revelations not many wanted posted for public inspection. In 1870, categories and questions about slaves no longer existed, of course, and the question framers shifted their attention to other areas. The Congressional Inquisition included questions not only about wealth, but also debts. Amounts of wages, prices, and taxes were required, along with information on insurance. Crimes were recorded, along with pauperism, physical and mental shortcomings, and religious beliefs. For several censuses, marshals had been instructed to safeguard the confidentiality of census information. How well this was done is a matter of question, since everything was left to the moral judgment of men paid poorly for a thankless task. The 10th Census Act, which provided for the 1880 census, was the first to contain a legal ban on the disclosure of census information. By now, civilian supervisors and enumerators had replaced the marshals and their assistants. Each of these new civil servants was required to swear not to disclose any information contained in the schedule, lists, or statements obtained by me to any person or persons except to my superior officers, quote, unquote. The new law had teeth in it. Conviction of a violation of this trust carried with it a fine of up to $500, and in 1880 that sum was enough to make a tempted officer think very carefully of the risk. Another safeguard to privacy was instituted at the same time. Until then, it had been the practice to retain original census schedules in the local area, but in 1800, these were sent to Washington. Only name, age, sex, and race were filed locally. This must have been a relief to Americans, because by 1890, not just 6 questions were asked, but 470, and many of them were drafted not by census officials, but by Congress itself. The all-time low in census prying came in 1880 and 1890. Southern Reconstruction was faltering and racism was strong in the Congress and in the Supreme Court as well. The census form question about race required not just a response of white or Negro, but all the many shades between. Specifically, the census asked if a person was Negro, mulatto, quadroon, or octoroon. The enumerator's guidebook in 1880 contained this instruction. Be particularly careful in reporting the class mulatto. The word here is generic and includes all persons having any perceptible trace of African blood. Important scientific results depend on the correct determination of this class, quote, unquote. Not only race, but physical differences and mental problems were of almost morbid interest to the framers of census questions. By 1890, not even brief lists of persons enumerated were filed in the local courts. A municipal government could obtain such lists only by requesting them from the Bureau of the Census. However, though secrets were safeguarded locally, the slow change of procedure moved those same secrets to a central location within the federal government. In time, this development set off fear in some Americans that they had slipped from the frying pan into the fire. As government grew in size and power, citizens began to fear a Big Brother able to spy on them from a central site to which all information was channeled under penalty of law. It was bad enough to have local or state authorities privy to one's secrets, but to know that such information was available to the federal government frightened some people far more, even with the assurance that the information would not be used for purposes of taxation, regulation, or investigation. With the creation of the Bureau of the Census in 1902, census-taking became a more professional operation. Continuity was achieved when the same employees were involved in successive censuses, and attempts were made in 1910 to further guarantee confidentiality for citizens required to tell more and more to enumerators. The $500 fine for employees of the Bureau of the Census who violated confidentiality was raised to $1,000 or imprisonment for up to 2 years or both. Penalties enforced today are greater. In the area of personal information, the director of the census was given the discretion to release to governors and local courts of record certified copies of statistical totals for states or jurisdictions, respectively. Another power given the director was that of furnishing to individuals, quote, such data from the population schedules as may be desired for genealogical or other proper purposes, unquote. The right of states and courts to census information was limited in 1920 census legislation. In no case shall the information furnished be used to the detriment of the person or persons to whom such information relates, quote unquote. In 1923, however, the names and addresses of illiterates were still being furnished to some states. The census inquisition abated in 1930 when the Census Bureau itself began to write the questions asked in the schedules. It has continued to do this task and has set up pre-census conferences to seek the help of those to be counted. Its aim is to gather the greatest amount of information without offending the sensitivities of those who must respond to census questionnaires. The 1940 census asked a question on income. Persons earning more than $5,000 were requested to indicate so on the form. Among those objecting was United States Senator Charles Toby of New Hampshire, who called the question unconstitutional and in violation of the Bill of Rights. Toby's battle cry was, "Eternal vigilance is still the price of liberty. Stand up and fight." Many individuals and organizations agreed, and a campaign was launched to prevent the inclusion of the income question. The Bureau compromised by including a separate form to be mailed directly to Washington. However, only about 2% of the total questioned used them. Prior to the 1970 census, there was a more serious confidentiality controversy, generally thought to have been inspired by earlier proposals for a national data bank that would consolidate all sorts of information about Americans and make it accessible through a single identification, such as the Social Security number. This time, Congressman Jackson E. Betts launched a campaign to limit drastically the questions of the 1970 census, and many groups joined the effort. Betts argued for making all but 7 questions voluntary. Arguments against prying questions on the census, including cartoons asking, "With whom do you share your shower?" The American Civil Liberties Union got involved, but accepted every question except that concerning race. After all the argument, the response to the 1970 census was excellent, and returns came in even faster than had been expected. And there I shall quit.